Radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Radio Catskill.
From the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, September is Preparedness Month. The American Red Cross has responded to nearly twice as many large disasters across the country as it did a decade ago. Today, we'll learn what you need to do to be prepared for fires, floods, and more. We chat with the executive director of the Hudson Valley chapter of the American Red Cross. Delaware Valley Raptor Center is located in Milford. It's a nonprofit education organization dedicated to the conservation of birds of prey, hawks, eagles, owls, falcons, and vultures. We chat with its executive director, Bill Streeter. And memoir writing. Ever think about writing your memoir, but not sure how to go about it, or even if you should? Don't worry, you don't have to be famous or infamous to write about it. We'll chat with Penelope Garrity about how to write your memoir, plus Maggie Fitzpatrick. First, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. The House returns from its summer recess today with a long to-do list. On the top of that list is funding the government. And as NPR's Lexi Schapitl reports, it's a task that will test Speaker Kevin McCarthy's leadership.
Fiscal conservatives in the House are calling for spending levels that are lower than what Speaker McCarthy and President Biden agreed to during debt ceiling negotiations this spring. Those proposals would be dead on arrival in the democratically held Senate. House and Senate leaders hope to pass a short-term spending bill to avoid a government shutdown and allow more time for negotiations. But McCarthy will again face resistance from hardliners in his party. They have demanded border security funding, changes to Pentagon policy, and other concessions in exchange for supporting a short-term agreement. McCarthy could pass a stopgap measure with Democratic votes, but doing so could endanger his speakership. Lexi Schapitl, NPR News, Washington.
The overall death toll from devastating flooding in eastern Libya is not clear, but rescuers are reported to have recovered hundreds of bodies in the eastern city of Derna alone, and authorities say thousands are missing. Many towns in eastern Libya have been hit by catastrophic flooding caused by Mediterranean storm Daniel. Authorities say heavy rainfall and floods washed away entire neighborhoods. Rescuers in Morocco racing to save those who may still be trapped beneath the rubble following Friday's 6.8 magnitude earthquake that struck in the mountains near Marrakech. The American NGO team Rubicon is in Marrakech, but Kader Gagnéa says his team is still waiting for the Moroccan government to accept its offer of assistance.
We're an emergency medical team type 1 mobile, which means that the core of what we do is access very difficult area mobile. So we have vehicles, we'll have small vehicles, or we'll drop by helicopter, and then we'll reach those area with medical teams.
Officials say at least 2,800 people were killed and more than 2,500 others were injured in the quake. Many communities lack food, water, electricity, and shelter. Stocks opened lower this morning as Google goes on trial for allegedly abusing its dominant position in the search engine business. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average has slipped about 68 points in early trading.
The Justice Department accuses Google of violating antitrust law by paying for preferential placement of its search engine on smartphones and other devices. The trial, which is called the biggest antitrust crackdown in decades, is expected to last about 10 weeks. Another tech giant, Apple, is unveiling its latest crop of iPhones today. Apple's hoping the new models might help to reverse a slowdown in iPhone sales over the last three quarters. Charter cable subscribers were able to watch Monday Night Football on ESPN last night. ESPN owner Disney settled a dispute with the cable company, ending a blackout hours before kickoff. The New York Jets beat the Buffalo Bills 22-16. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is in Russia. State media say Kim boarded his personal train for the journey on Sunday afternoon. He is expected to meet with President Vladimir Putin tomorrow in Vladivostok. Kim is expected to seek Russian economic aid and military tech in exchange for munitions to be used for Russia's war in Ukraine. Heavy rain continues in southern China the week after a typhoon made landfall there. Seven people have died due to flooding and three people are missing. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
Nearly 70,000 people have been evacuated in the southwestern province of Sichuan due to the risk of further landslides. There have been about 100 landslides so far across China caused by Typhoon Haiku, which hit last week. Rescue operations are currently underway across the provinces of Guangdong, Fujian, Guangxi, and Hainan as people are trapped in their homes and on highways by floodwaters. Meanwhile, people are searching for an emergency worker in the southern province of Guangxi who was swept away by the floodwaters. China experiences seasonal rains, and its southern regions are routinely buffeted by typhoons. But flooding has gotten worse as cities become denser and water-absorbing natural habitats are destroyed. Emily Fang, NPR News, Taipei.
An advisory panel for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is to meet today with updated COVID-19 vaccines on the agenda. The CDC panel must sign off on the FDA's decision yesterday to approve the shots from Pfizer and Moderna and recommend how best to use this round of vaccinations. I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. September is National Preparedness Month, and the Eastern New York region of the American Red Cross is urging everyone to prepare for worsening extreme weather conditions affecting communities across the 27-county region, including flooding and damaging storms. Joining us now is Hudson Valley Executive Director of the Red Cross, John Vale. John, welcome back.
Hi, good morning, Tim. Happy National Preparedness Month.
Yes, you too. Thanks for being here to remind us of this. You know, severe weather like this that we're talking about is a worsening national trend. And in fact, American Red Cross says it's responded to nearly twice as many large disasters across the country as it did a decade ago. That seems to be rather amazing, but also seems to show us that climate change is real.
Yes. Yeah. As rapidly, you know, intensifying weather related events, they're really posing some serious challenges to our humanitarian work. It upends lives, it devastates our communities. And our organization at this time is really racing to adapt our services and help grow our disaster response capacity across the country.
And the Red Cross has announced an ambitious national plan to take action. Can we talk a little bit about this national plan and what folks need to know?
Yeah. So, you know, we're rolling out, you know, programs throughout the country. And what that looks like here in our Eastern New York region really is going to focus on recruiting and training more volunteers. And these volunteers are crucial to our ability to respond to disasters, both locally, you know, here in the Hudson Valley, as well as across the country. And we'll also be joining our community partners. And we offer a variety of free emergency preparedness programs. And these are really geared to help our adults and children here in, you know, in the Hudson Valley better prepare for these emergencies.
Yeah, and part of the life-saving actions also we're talking about are getting a kit, making a plan, and being informed. There are so many things to keep an eye on. You know, I'm looking at rain and floods in our area, but then I just checked the weather forecast and I type in weather.com and there's a giant graphic of Hurricane Lee and that, you know, the headline New England in the cone showing it possibly hitting, northern New England. But of course, we don't know where it's going. So we need to be prepared for really everything.
Yes. So what, you know, we really urge during National Preparedness Month is to take advantage of those three life-saving actions you just mentioned. So that includes building an emergency preparedness kit. You know, this is full of all the items, you know, non-perishable foods, a gallon of water per person per day, a flashlight. Actually, you might want to pack two flashlights because I guarantee you one of those won't work when you try to utilize it. But that also includes, you know, coming up with a plan for both you and your family. If you have a pet, please, you know, we urge folks, you know, don't evacuate without your pets. So they need to be a part of that plan as well. And then finally, stay informed. You know, this is going to be crucial during, you know, both before, during, and after a disaster. So we're urging folks to take this time now, you know, to review that plan, make that kit, and please make sure you stay safe during a local emergency.
And as we've seen in our region, even this summer, the flash flooding could come when you least expect it, in areas that you least expect it. So at a minimum, you should have these basic supplies in a kit, a survival kit. You mentioned the battery. You mentioned medications, other things that are on that list. And there's 15 things. I'm not going to go through everything, but you can go to redcross.org and see. But some of the things you may not think about, you know, extra cash, an emergency blanket, a multi-purpose tool, copies of your personal documents, and then also consider the needs of all family members when you're adding supplies to your kit, like you mentioned, pets or babies. Again, I think it may sound in some ways, for some listeners, perhaps extreme. We don't live on a coastal area. We don't really necessarily see hurricanes every time during hurricane season or other disasters. But these things are changing rapidly.
Yeah, and again, we see here in the Northeast a variety of emergencies, from, you know, tropical storms that make their way up here into the Northeast. But we see, you know, ice storms, blizzards, you know, these severe thunderstorms that roll through. So having these items ahead of time, you know, you may lose power for an extended time period. You know, that's really going to be the crucial part, you know, to our community staying safe during an emergency. And as you had mentioned, you know, it was just back in July we saw that flash flooding down in the Hudson Valley in Highland Falls. So really, it's, you know, imperative as a community we prepare. And as we're looking at, you know, Hurricane Lee, you know, it was only back in 2011 we had another tropical storm Lee come up here into the Hudson Valley and really pose some serious challenges, especially here in the Greene County and other counties here in our Hudson Valley area.
And make a plan is the other step within that emergency plan. A little bit more simplified in the sense of like identifying household members who are responsible for each member and what to do as a team, basically.
Yeah, that's, again, crucial. And we love training folks ahead of time. So we do offer these free preparedness trainings. And as you mentioned, you can go to redcross.org/prepare. And this could be applied from disasters, both big and small. So, you know, what we see as our number one response across the country is actually a home fire. So a lot of these same skills we teach can be utilized to keep your family safe during all times. So that's really the most important part there.
I also like that on the website, redcross.org, there are templates for folks, a family disaster plan template in English and Spanish. And if you look at the template, it really is, you know, listing every member of the household, all of the pets, what's the plan of action, and then also who's responsible for each of these types of tasks in the event of a disaster, like the disaster kit. Who's the family member responsible? Who's responsible for family medical information? And these are things we really need to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's during the onset of a disaster is not the time to be having that conversation.
Right.
So really appreciate, again, folks, just taking a good look at that. A little bit of delegation, again, can make sure everyone's going to get through that emergency safely.
And prepare by type of emergency. We've mentioned, you know, all the different types of emergencies, and it seems like they're more common across the area. Home fire, hurricane, wildfires. We saw some of that coming down from the smoke in Canada, but it doesn't mean that we're not susceptible to that. And of course, winter storm safety. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Executive Director John Vail. He's the Executive Director of the Hudson Valley Chapter of the American Red Cross. September is National Preparedness Month, and he and the American Red Cross are urging everyone to be prepared for intensifying weather-related events that pose serious challenges not only to the humanitarian work of the Red Cross, but all of the people that it serves. That's everybody that's listening, really. So more disaster responses and adapting to the climate crisis. You are also looking at actions to adapt your services and grow the capacity of the Red Cross to adapt to this climate crisis. What are some of those things that are happening as well?
Yeah, so again, what we need, and really this is our mission, is to alleviate human suffering in the face of emergencies through the power of our volunteers and the generosity of our donors. So really, capacity, you know, looking at the volunteer side, we need additional volunteers, you know, to step forward and help deliver relief and care to families, you know, by joining our team of volunteers. It's really quite simple. You can contact our volunteer services team by calling 518-387-9441, or you can send an email to join ENY@redcross.org. Again, we have a lot of volunteer opportunities, whether it's responding to disasters. And of course, we also do support our nation's blood supply and others. So again, there's a lot of opportunities out there. If you're looking for a way to give back to your communities in a meaningful way, again, we really need to build that capacity now ahead of our disasters so that way we can respond accordingly.
And in July, the Eastern region of the New York region of the American Red Cross did respond to the flooding that impacted those several communities in the Hudson Valley. Can you talk a little bit about what you guys did and what you saw and some of the community partners and volunteers coming together to help with that?
Sure. So, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, the hurricane, and usually with storms like that, we have a little bit of notice so we can prepare. But what we saw in July is what we call a no-noticed event. So it was a flash flooding, kind of a one-in-a-thousand-year storm rolled through a community down in Orange County and several others here in the Hudson Valley, and just dropped a ton of rain in a very short amount of time. So together, and really this is the important part, you know, we're going to partner with our community members and groups and organizations. We provided, you know, our trained disaster workers, and they were able to operate an emergency shelter for a little over a week. During that time, we helped to serve over 500 meals and snacks to those individuals and other community members that were affected by the flooding. And then when we were looking towards the recovery process, you know, we helped to distribute more than 900 cleanup kits and other relief supplies. That includes, you know, gloves and bleach and other cleaning items, especially for those homes that had that, you know, their basements flooded and needed to now clean up before we have mold, you know, start to take place in those areas. So really those services, in addition, you know, we provide wraparound services to our community, which is really incredible. You know, we have amazing disaster health services volunteers and disaster mental health counselors. You know, these are trained, licensed professionals that volunteer their time to make sure our clients feel care and, you know, and comforted, you know, when we have, you know, unfortunate, you know, to open up a shelter for someone who had to leave their home. So that's really part of that kind of response, you know, efforts that we provide, you know, during a disaster. And, you know, we're talking a lot about preparedness, so we hope folks stay safe. But in the event of an emergency, you know, we are trained and ready to provide care.
And, of course, climate and weather impacts the national blood supply. The Red Cross has seen a significant shortfall in blood and platelet donations over the summer and over the last month. And now there is, I saw this morning, there was an alert, a national blood shortage. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on and how folks can help?
Yeah, so, you know, we've seen now the pretty significant shortfall in blood and platelet donations over the last month. You know, that makes it really difficult to keep pace with the need for blood products, especially during climate-related events. You know, our blood and platelet donations can go uncollected. You know, this is due to disruptions due to events like hurricanes or wildfires or extreme heat. And that altogether puts a further strain on our nation's blood supply. And again, as we've seen these extreme weather events worsening, that's really translating to more blood drive cancellations. So last year, that was over 1,300 blood drives that were canceled due to weather. And that's about 23% higher than the average of the prior 9 years. So, again, we're seeing this kind of correlation between, you know, disaster, climate events, and even now the effects on our blood supply. And really anyone who's had, you know, a loved one that needed a blood transfusion or, you know, is going through a, you know, battle with cancer, blood donations are that crucial, you know, really just critical support that we need. So we're urging donors of all blood types, you know, all types are needed, you know, especially, you know, there's that emergency need for platelet donors and type O blood donors right now to make an appointment. So, you know, we're keeping a close eye on this, on this new tropical storm, you know, that's out there in the Northeast. And we hope it stays out to sea, but certainly we're bracing for possible more cancellations. So now is the time, if you haven't donated, you know, please, you know, consider, if you're able to go out there and help us make sure we can get the blood products to where they need to be.
Yeah, I mentioned the shortfall last month. It looks like about 30,000 blood and platelet donations are short in August as normally needed. And then 2 weeks ago, Hurricane Idalia forced dozens of blood drive cancellations, which mm-hmm. compounded that shortage. So right now, the Red Cross is in urgent need of blood donations. You can get more information at redcross.org. Anything else, John, that you want to mention about staying prepared in September, and not just only September, but all year round?
No, again, just please, you know, if there are any, you know, additional questions, you can go to redcross.org/prepare. And again, we really urge you, again, there's lots of ways you can give back to help your communities. You know, we have a lot of amazing nonprofits and organizations doing work here in the Hudson Valley. However, again, as we discussed, we do need that additional support for our volunteers, you know, capacity to deliver our mission day in and day out. So if you're interested in learning a little bit more, go to redcross.org/volunteer today. You can learn some more information on our volunteer opportunities and join our team of humanitarians that are delivering aid, you know, both here in the Hudson Valley and throughout the United States.
And you can also stay prepared by going to redcross.org, get the facts about what you should do if an emergency or a disaster occurs. And they've got that handy family template for a disaster plan, which I think is really helpful because you may not know where to start. And this lays it out very clearly about what you should do and who's responsible in the event of an emergency or a disaster. John Vail, Hudson Valley Executive Director of the Red Cross, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tim.
All right. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, Maggie Fitzpatrick is here. It's Tuesday, and we're moving toward health. Sometimes less is more, she says. This is Radio Chatskill.
Set your controls for the heart of the sun and tune in to hear the psychedelic synth situations of electronic hairpieces with your host, Nikki Beto. In this new weekly program, I'll be spinning retro synth, psychedelic, and experimental records Thursday nights at 10 p.m. following Connect the Dots at 9. Only on Radio Catskill.
Listen local.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News. Tune in to our headline news service for stories about indigenous communities across the country and around the world. Hear about top concerns facing Native nations. Tribal history, language, and culture is also part of indigenous life. Check out our headline news service to learn more. Tune in here for National Native News.
Weekdays during All Things Considered.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Moving Toward Health is the health and wellness column in the Sullivan County Democrat, written by Maggie Fitzpatrick. She joins us every Tuesday, and she's here this morning to tell us about today's column, which is Sometimes Less is More. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Well, let's see. We talk about your inspiration sometimes when it comes to these columns. What was your inspiration for Sometimes Less is More?
Well, there were a couple things going on here, and this article actually started out completely different when I started writing it to how it ended. But the main idea for this article was inflammation. Mm-hmm. And this is something that is something that a lot of people deal with and we don't even realize, and I was one of those people. Mm-hmm. And inflammation is... It can be an acute response in our body. Think like an allergic reaction, right? You get stung by a bee, you're allergic. Oh my goodness, we have a problem, right? But also we can struggle with inflammation in a chronic sense, right? Over a long period of time, your body can become frustrated with you, right? And your choices. And we can deal with inflammation that can kind of creep up on us.
What are some examples of chronic inflammation for folks who may not be aware of it, or think it may be, oh, that's just my back hurts. It always does.
Yeah. So it can look like a lot of different things. But if you think of like, you know, a common one you think of would be like arthritis, mm-hmm. right? The very common, we hear about that. It manifests very physically. We know about that diagnosis, right? But for me, it was my acne was an example of an inflammatory skin condition, right?
So I think some folks may not see that as chronic inflammation, but it is. It is your skin becoming inflamed in a way that is continuous.
Exactly. Or you can think of like IBS, mm-hmm. right? Inflammatory bowel syndrome, where what you're eating is not agreeing with your body over long periods of time. And then we have this chronic inflammation underlying that will then show up in acute responses. So with acne, it's like you see like a blemish, right? Or with your arthritis, you have like the weather's really bad. And then all of a sudden, like you're in a lot of pain, right? But that happens because we have this underlying chronic inflammation going on as well.
So how does something like acne as a chronic inflammation impact you in terms of just exercise and health?
Yeah. So where the less is more comes in here is that we get so wrapped up in like, okay, I have something that I want to improve, right? I have a health goal I want to achieve. I want to do this thing. So I need to do more, right? I need to add in another supplement, or I need to add in more exercise, or I need to add in, you know, this, that, or the other thing, whatever it is that we're trying to do. And when it comes to some of our health goals, like decreasing inflammation, sometimes what we actually need to do is less, right? Sometimes the changes that we need to make actually come around removing things from our, you know, current lifestyle or our current protocol. So for me in this situation with my personal example of my acne, it was actually removing some things from my diet. Right. It was removing some intensity from my workout. It was removing some work from my day so I could go to bed earlier.
Did you know what those things were, or did you kind of come at it from a let's try this, let's try that?
So for me personally, I actually, you know, it was a combination of my education, right, my background in this, but I have a coach right now who's helping me do this. I have a medical professional helping me do this with my specific example. And I think that that's really important when, you know, there's a lot of things we can tackle on our own, and yet there's a lot of things that we can't.
So right? What are some things for folks who may not have a coach or be as knowledgeable as you are to look at? Not necessarily is going to be the thing, but if you are experiencing some chronic inflammation, you may want to look at this type of thing in your diet or this type of thing in your exercise routine.
Yeah. So this week we're talking about three specific things that are really, really beneficial across the board. The first one diet wise is sugar. Sugar is very inflammatory in the body for a couple reasons, but the easiest way to explain it is when we eat sugar, our blood sugar spikes, right? And what that does is it prompts our body to release a lot of insulin. And along with the release of insulin comes a couple other things that happen. But one is the release of cortisol, which is a stress hormone in our body, right? Mm-hmm. And so not only are we having blood sugar spikes and crashes and, you know, changes in our energy, we're also telling our body that it's under stress. And I'm not here to say that, you know, sugar is the devil and you should never eat it, because I still eat it a little bit too. But if it's something that, if inflammation is something you're struggling with, that's definitely something you want to pay attention to.
It's also important to look for things that have hidden sugar, things that you may not think would have as much sugar because they've been marketed as healthy, or you think that they're healthy. Things like yogurt or granola bars, even like instant oatmeal.
That is such a really good point, because that was actually where I found a lot of the sugar in my diet. Was like, I'm eating this protein bar that says it's healthy.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's like, oh, this is healthy. But in reality, it's like brown rice syrup instead of high fructose corn syrup. Right. So like, okay, that's better. But in reality, that's breaking down into sugar in your body. Oats are breaking down into sugar in your body, right? And so if in this very specific example, you're struggling with something inflammation related, that's something you want to pay attention to.
One of the things that was a surprising source of hidden sugar to me was pasta sauce.
Like, yes.
Like a canned pasta sauce or jarred pasta sauce.
Yep.
It could have between 6 to 12 grams of sugar per half serving.
I know. And like, this is something, that you really want to pay attention to. Especially labels can be really tricky when you're looking at food, right? So it could say no sugar added, but that means they didn't add any more sugar than they already had.
Right.
So you want to look at the back. Yeah, exactly.
So I did want to go off into the, like, you know, labeling, but like, again, look for these sugars, which is the thing that causes some inflammation.
Yep.
What is another thing to look for?
Yeah. So another thing we want to look for in like the lifestyle category, but we'll specifically talk about exercise, is intensity of exercise, right? So when we talk about exercise, we can talk about duration, which is like how long you're exercising for. We can talk about intensity, which is how difficult it is within a period of time, right? So I have not cut out all high intensity exercise, but we want to scale that back a little bit, because our bodies can't differentiate between stress. So whether it's good stress like exercise or bad stress like everything is going wrong at work, right? Our body can't differentiate between that. So when we have inflammation and stress levels are already high and our body's already in this cycle of being inflamed, we want to pull those stress levels down in many different areas. So that's one place where you can swap out, you know, your HIIT class for maybe a walk or a bike ride or something that you're still moving, you're still getting all of the benefits of exercise. Even like a strength training session that's just not as high of intensity will be better for your body and your recovery than going high intensity every day.
And the other thing is sleep. And we're not talking about less sleep. We're talking about more sleep.
More sleep.
Sometimes yes. less is more, but not when it comes to sleep.
Exactly. In this example, it's less work, more sleep, right? less scrolling on your phone, less doing something that this was my personal example, is my bedtime was around like 11:30 for the past however many years. That was what time I was going to sleep. And I just had this idea that I couldn't go to sleep any earlier. Like, it just wasn't possible. And one day I just said, you know what? I'm just going to bed at 9. Like, I'm just going to bed at 9. I'm just going to do whatever is necessary for me to go to bed earlier. And since then, I've been pretty consistent about going to bed earlier. And I've been thinking, I'm like, what was I doing? Because it's all working out just fine. And like, obviously this isn't possible for everyone, depending on your work schedule or your kids or, you know, whatever is going on. But even if we can come back, maybe just you go to bed 10 minutes earlier this week, and then next week, 10 minutes earlier than that. The week after that, 10 minutes earlier than that. Those small incremental changes of getting more sleep will greatly impact your ability of your body to recover. Right. And we want to try to get as much sleep as possible.
And then you might notice that inflammation going down or retreating a bit.
Exactly. Yeah. Because that's what your body needs, is that chance to recover.
And how long ago was it when you sort of had this realization? Was it within the last week or so?
Of sleep?
Well, this whole idea of slowing down, less is more.
No, I've actually been working on this entire year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And finally, I was like, all right, I think I feel qualified to talk about it at this point, because, you know, I never want to jump into something and say, oh, I just learned this new thing and let me teach it to you. You know, I really want to make sure that I am practicing what I preach and doing the thing. And so this is something I've been working on all of 2023.
Have you noticed a decrease in the inflammation then?
Astronomical change.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And you're feeling better?
I'm feeling so much better. My skin has like almost completely cleared up. I've dropped maybe 12 to 15 pounds I didn't know that I had to lose. And it wasn't like fat. It was my body was swollen, right? And I didn't think that my body was that upset with me, because like I say in the article, you know, I'm a health professional. Like I eat my vegetables and my protein and I exercise and all of that stuff. And it was just not quite right.
Yeah.
You know, something was off.
So, and you realize something's off, and sometimes less is more. And as you say, sometimes slowing down and removing things is the best approach.
Sometimes it is.
Maggie Fitzpatrick writes the Moving Toward Health column for the Sullivan County Democrat. It is out every week. You can read about it in the paper today or online at scdemocratonline.com. Thanks, Maggie.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week.
Yes.
All right. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we're talking about birds of prey, raptors, hawks, eagles, owls, falcons, and how you can conserve and educate folks about them. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com.
Tavern on Main, a neighborhood bar and restaurant on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York, featuring local American fare, specialty cocktails, craft beers, and Sunday brunch. Menu and hours online at TavernOnMainNY.com.
And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Callison Stratton, a singer-songwriter, public historian, and host of Liberation Station here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Liberation Station is a show that highlights the work of female and femme-presenting performers across genre and time. It's my little way of balancing the scales of representation on the radio. Join me for Liberation Station every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Hey everybody, this is Jeff Loeffler of The Deep End, and you can join me each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight as I explore the deep end of the catalogs of bands maybe you know, maybe you don't know. You'll hear some Rolling Stones, Grateful Dead, Government Mule, right alongside bands like the Electric Peanut Butter Conspiracy, Kula Shaker, and Supergrass. That's The Deep End each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight right here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Delaware Valley Raptor Center, located in Milford, is a private nonprofit tax-exempt organization dedicated to the conservation of birds of prey, you know, the hawks and eagles, owls, falcons, vultures that we see around. Their goal is to provide professional care for their active and retired education birds, as well as retired foster parents who, like their education birds, were irreparably injured and have called the DVRC their home. Most of them for years and some even decades. As we mentioned yesterday, the Delaware Highlands Conservancy is hosting its Meadow Party coming up this Saturday. WJFF volunteer Barb Demmer spoke to one of the presenters, who is Bill Streeter of the Delaware Valley Raptor Center.
So, Bill, what birds are you planning to bring with you to the Meadow Party?
I plan to bring an American kestrel, a peregrine falcon, a red-tailed hawk, a great horned owl, a saw-whet owl, and a bald eagle.
That's a lot of birds. What do you think the audience will get to see? What's the program going to be like?
Well, I like to say the program's not a lecture, you know, because my first purpose is to entertain and then to teach people and then to kind of wow them. But that's not up to me. If they're in the presence of the birds take care of that pretty easily, because if you're sitting very close to an eagle or a hawk or an owl, it's pretty impressive. So I try to keep people off their phones for a while and keep them entertained and locked in for about an hour. The same as if you'd go to a movie or a play or something like that. You get to live in the moment, but you also get to experience something new and learn things along the way.
As somebody who's attended some of your presentations over the years, I can attest to the wow factor.
Uh-huh.
What defines a raptor?
A raptor... There are a lot of predatory birds out there. So very often you say raptors and birds of prey, and they are birds of prey. But birds of prey and raptors are actually, they have a lot of similar characteristics. They have a hooked beak, which they use to tear up their food. And they have large feet with long, extended, sharp talons. That's what really makes a raptor.
As you named the birds that you're going to be bringing with you, it sounded to me as though there's a vast array of size of bird.
There is a vast array of size of bird. I mean, kestrels and saw-whets are 3-4 ounces. My
wow.
Bald eagle weighs 10 pounds. So they really run the gamut from very small to very, very large. The smallest owl in the world lives out west. I can't remember the name of it. Oh my God, this is great for the radio. Anyway, it's about an ounce and a half.
That's amazing.
Very, very tiny owl.
How are the raptors doing in our area these days?
I think they're doing pretty well. This is the time of year to notice because birds are on their fall migration right now. They start usually late August, early September, and it goes through December. So there are a lot of sites where you can go to that keep the raptor counts, and then you can compare year after year after year just to see how they're doing. That's how we really figure it out. I mean, there are people out there doing the science, but there are an awful lot of people out there that are just doing the counting and saying, well, kestrel numbers are up this year, or they're down this year, or broadwing hawk numbers are up or they're down, and you can keep track that way.
I remember hearing early in the season that there was some concern that there were fewer eagles in the Upper Delaware Corridor. Is that the case, do you think?
I haven't heard that. I assume that the eagles are doing very well here simply because if I drive that area, I see so many of them. They've come back extremely well in the past half century. It's actually really exciting because if you think of birds that have been on the earth for like a million years, and then all of a sudden there's this really tiny blip in geologic time because of human interference with basically with DDT and habitat destruction and other things that the population plummeted so low to only 400 breeding pairs in the lower 48 states. And now we have upwards of 300,000 bald eagles flying around in the lower 48 states. And that's all because we cleaned up the environment. We cleaned up the water, which we tend, if you're young, you take it for granted today. But if you're of my age, you realize when there was no protection with the waterways that there was so much pollution when I was a child growing up. It was absolutely incredible. So you clean up their waterways, you clean up their habitat, you get rid of the DDT, and within half a century, they just rebound tremendously. So they're very, very resilient. They just need a chance.
Those are great things on a policy level. How about as an individual? What can somebody who lives around here do to help raptors?
Not shoot them, for one. That's probably the way you can help them the most. Talk to other people about them. Get people excited about seeing them. If you are a hunter, switch to non-lead shot. That's a big deal. The Pennsylvania Game Commission is really pushing this. I was really happy to hear that, because if you've ever seen an eagle die of lead poisoning, and many, many, many of them do, they'll come down on a carcass that has been shot. And if you don't bury the gut pile or anything like that, it only takes a piece of lead, the grain of rice, to kill an eagle. So that would be a really, really good thing if people started switching to non-lead shot. And it's a very small price to pay.
So what kind of animals would they be feeding on that might have been shot by a hunter and has lead in its system?
Well, they're scavengers as well. So if you kill a deer, and if there's shot in the deer, and it doesn't take much, because when a bullet passes through a deer, it fragments into sometimes fragments are as small as what looks like powder, like they're spritzed with powder. And it distributes throughout the animal. And if you eat that, you get poisoned. Humans aren't nearly as susceptible to it as birds are. It takes very little bit to poison a bird. So that's probably the main thing. Bigger game is something. I mean, obviously, if you shot something small like a rabbit and couldn't retrieve it, the same thing would happen. But usually lead poisoning starts in the area around deer season.
Hmm.
Fishing tackle, same thing.
Fishing tackle?
Bald eagles will eat fish. So if you use lead shot or split shot sinkers were very, very popular. I don't know if I'm not a fisherman, so I don't want to be inundated with calls from fishermen saying, you can't even buy this stuff anymore. I don't know. So I probably shouldn't be speaking out of my hat like this, but I just remember a lot of fishing sinkers and everything were lead. So if a bald eagle eats that, if it gets caught in a fish and the bald eagle ends up swallowing it, that would be a big deal too.
Wow. What about the bird count you were referring to? Is there room for amateurs in that?
The bird what?
The bird count.
The bird count? Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you hit the migration ridges, there are places where people go where you can really see birds fly through. And you could go to a website, the Hawk Migration Association of North America, HMANA.org. You go on that website, you just click on your state, and it tells you all the major hawk watching points where you can go. And if you go up to these areas, there are hawk watching fanatics up there that are more than happy to teach people how to identify these birds and talk to them about them. I know I do when I'm up on the ridge. I like to talk to other people about what I'm seeing.
What have you found rewarding about the work that you've done over the years with these birds?
I just love birds of prey. I just love raptors. I got into it years ago when my wife became a falconer. We were living in Massachusetts, and she started flying hawks, and she was a music major in college. I was a biology major and then the zoologist and all of that. So she kind of turned me on to it. And then I started flying hawks as a falconer, and then people started dropping off injured birds of prey at our house, figuring, well, these are the people that you go to. Eventually, I ended up learning wildlife medicine from Tufts University Wildlife Clinic. And it was my wife, Stephanie, who really wanted to start doing rehab. She was a caregiver, and she was the woman behind the center who made it really run. And together we incorporated the Delaware Valley Raptor Center, and it just took off over the years. but just being around them. I mean, it's simple, selfish reasons. I love birds of prey. We figured out a way to do something to help them and to be around them. And, you know, 40 years later, I you know, still walk outside in the morning to feed the birds at our center, and they just make me smile. You know, it's they're all different as not only as species, but as individuals. And if you fix one up and if you put one back into the wild, that's like the greatest thing. You know, to me, it was great. We're not rehabbing anymore. We're just doing education, and our center serves as a sanctuary for the birds that remain in our center. But it's just been a great ride being with them and talking to people about them, which is why I still do the programs.
Well, it's a real community impact. So the Meadow Party takes place at the Van Scott Nature Preserve in Beach Lake, Pennsylvania. Bill, you're on deck at 1 o'clock. Thanks so much for talking with us.
I am very, very happy that you contacted me. It was nice to be here.
More information and registration for the day is at the DelawareHighlandsConservancy.org.
That's Barb Demarest speaking to Bill Streeter of the Delaware Valley Raptor Center. And again, the Meadow Party is Sunday, September 17th from 11 to 4. We'll take a break and we'll come back and talk about how to write a memoir. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hurleyville Performing Arts Center and the Black Library present Culture Fest, 50 Years of Hip Hop, celebrating a half century of cultural innovation Sunday in Hurleyville, featuring local talent, dance performances, spoken word, art, and musical acts, plus food and local vendors. Culture Fest, 50 Years of Hip Hop, 2 to 7 p.m. Sunday, September 17th, Fireman's Park in Hurleyville. Info at HurleyvilleArtsCenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Ever think about writing your memoir but not sure how to go about it, or even if you should? Don't worry, you don't have to be famous or infamous to write a memoir. Tomorrow at the Jeffersonville branch of the Western Sullivan Public Library at 2, Penelope Garrity hosts a memoir writing workshop, and she's joining us now on the phone to tell us more. Good morning, Penelope.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Can you explain to folks what's the difference between a memoir and an autobiography?
Well, the memoir as a genre has come into focus and popularity in the last 30 years or so, because an autobiography usually it can be a personal manuscript, but often for publication, it is only interesting to people if it's a celebrity or of some sort, a politician, a famous person who will write their autobiography. And the memoir was sort of a subgenre and slightly ignored by a lot of people. That changed recently within the last 50 years, when all sorts of people began to write memoirs, ordinary people with ordinary lives who had something to say about life and illustrate it through their own life story. However, the big difference between a memoir and an autobiography is that it is only a slice of life, an incident or a time frame that is much more restricted and much more focused on one or two themes. That's the big difference.
Why had the memoir gone out of style? You mentioned that it had not been very popular for a period of time and then has now come back.
Memoirs, again, were confused with autobiographies because they were written in the past by people who had something big to say, like a philosopher, or by famous people. Now they are very popular and have been for several years now, because all kinds of people are writing them, people who have a very interesting or unusual story to tell rather than a history of their whole life.
So as you said, these are select experiences that are just focusing on one period of the writer's life.
That is one way to limit them, one period. Many of the original, very popular memoirs back in the day were by the Wolf writers, brothers, who each wrote a memoir on their childhood. That is a time frame. And both were very different and both were very popular.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, you don't have to be famous or infamous to write a memoir. But I think that some people may think that a memoir only is for people who are famous. What do you say to that?
Sorry, I didn't get the last few words.
I think that
some people think
that it's only for folks who are famous or have a notoriety.
Right. No, I'm sure if they have been reading memoirs, they will realize that it is the ordinary person now who is often a bestseller on a memoir. You can write a memoir and sell very, very many copies about an accident that happened to you or an injustice that happened to you. Or some people write popular and best-selling memoirs on gardening. Now, that's a limitation by topic rather than time frame. Some people write memoirs about a national disaster and how it affected them. The trick is for a memoir is to make it about an interesting topic that people might want to read about, but turn it personal. Illustrate the topic with your experiences.
Your workshop starts at the Jeffersonville branch of the Western Sullivan Public Library tomorrow at 2 and runs through October 11th. If I were a first-time memorist, what are some exercises that you have to help find these worthy stories for a memoir?
Well, usually I start by revving people up to discover how wonderful the memoir is and how much it borrows from all the other genres. So you can be a mini fiction writer, not in that you make up the details of your memoir, but in that you use things like imagery, tension, description, and dialogue. You can also sort of reach out and borrow from newspaper reporting for the art of narration and introducing facts. You can use your poetic instincts for selection of words and images. It's a genre that I think it's the super genre myself.
Why do you think it's the super genre?
Because we borrow from all the other genres. We borrow their techniques, and that's what my job is to do as a facilitator, is to open up to the memoir writer, first of all, their story, which has to be true and as has to have happened to them, and that we spend a lot of time in the first session making sure that it's something significant. That means something that has two qualities. One is it important to other people? That means not just your story, but the topic. Grief or joy or doing something fulfilling that changes your life. It has to be important in general, and it has to have been important to you, because basically a memoir starts with a story, with a beginning, middle, and end. Something happens, you tell about it, and then you muse on what it means to you at the time it happened. And if it's happening some time ago, as most memoirs are, then you also bring it up to the present and show how your life may have been affected by it, or how your growing wisdom changes how you saw things. And that adds this wonderful dimension of complexity and beauty to the memoir.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Penelope Garrity, a local resident and PhD educator with more than 20 years of experience teaching literature and writing at high schools, colleges, universities, and personal writing workshops. She has a workshop on memoir writing at the Western Sullivan Public Library, the Jeffersonville branch, starting tomorrow and running through October 11th. Penelope, when you've been doing this for so many years, what's one of the biggest roadblocks for folks who are trying to attempt to write this memoir?
Well, there are two or three big roadblocks that we talk about a lot in the first session and in later ones. The first one is, of course, people who haven't done much writing are worried that they can't write. And so we have to sort of persuade them that they have something to say, and we get them started in the workshop telling a few stories on paper in the workshop about significant events in their lives. We start with sentence stories, then we go on to paragraph, and then we go on to two or three paragraphs. And all we want people to do is to see that they can put it down in writing. That's one big block, is can I really write? The other block is I've tried to write before, but I've had trouble, and I never seem to be able to finish. And I have a few exercises of how to handle that problem. And then the third block, of course, is not understanding the difference about what we just talked about between a memoir and an autobiography. And they say, they come into the class saying, well, my life is so ordinary. I've just been a housewife, or I was an insurance salesman, or whatever. And in actual fact, if we start with things, the very first exercise I do is write down the three big moments of your life. And then we go from there, and instead of write me a story of your life.
And share that powerful truth about your life. And that is what is impactful and engaging as a memoir. Before we go, have you written your memoir?
Well, I have been an educator for most of my career in writing and language development of French and English, and so did not have the time to write my memoirs. So I started since I've been retired, and unfortunately I branched out into all kinds of other genres, and then finally realized that I had a big story to tell, which is my 6 years living in West Africa and raising my children there. And that's the memoir I am completing as we speak.
Oh, amazing.
I'm on a, and I'm not sure whether I'm going to publish it, but I do want to finish it and make it publishable and share it with my family.
You're a good example for folks, not only in your experience as an educator, but in terms of just getting started, I guess, right? You're a good example in terms of, like, you know, finding time to do it, but having that great story to tell.
Yes, you have. I think the main thing is to encourage and give some techniques and some helpful tips to keep people going. And then I always set up the next step for each person's in session writing. And the first thing we do when we come in is everybody shares them and we workshop them a little bit, usually emphasizing the positive at the beginning. And then that keeps them going. One of the big hurdles is writing is hard. It takes time and it takes effort, and it can be discouraging. And the trick is to stay the course of at least the 4 weeks. And if you work hard, I promise that you will have either a short memoir of 3 pages or a nice 10 or 12 page piece that can be shared with the world.
Okay, the memoir writing workshop is at the Western Sullivan Public Library at the Jeffersonville branch starting tomorrow at 2, going until October 11th. You can learn more.
No, 13th.
Oh, sorry, 13th, you're right. Sorry, wrong day. Mm-hmm. WSPLonline.org is where you can register for the workshop and find out more information. Penelope Garrity.
They also can just drop in if they don't get around to registering tomorrow. They should just definitely come, maybe come a few minutes early to get registered.
Excellent. Thank you, Penelope Garrity. We appreciate you joining us today.
Well, I thank you. It's been nice talking to you.
That is all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can listen to the show at wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Chatskill comes from 52 and Vine, a wine and spirits shop in Jeffersonville featuring local, national, and eclectic vintners and distillers. 52andvine.com. From the Upper Delaware Welcome Center at the Narrowsburg Union, featuring information about regional attractions and activities, along with products by the region's artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen at Catskills Curated. NarrowsburgUnion.com.
I'm Adam Davidson, and I'm guest hosting the next episode of Freakonomics Radio. New technologies always scare us. Is AI any different?
I'm imagining a future where you're just kind of irrelevant if you refuse to lean on AI decision makers in all spheres of life.
Will AI be coming for your job? That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
How we make sense of the news and the world keeps changing. Who to trust and what's real are other moving targets. Let On the Media be your guide.
Saturday afternoon at 4.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. WJFF Jeffersonville. W233AH Monticello.